This is a podcast for Wednesday, November, I just said it, 16th, 2011, Ethics.
Ready to rock.
So, Aristotle is different than the other theories we've looked at so far. Just by way of review, how does Aristotle differ from, say, deontology or utilitarianism? How is his approach different?
Looks at the person rather than the act.
There you go. So if you can remember that, you got the first question on the exam right. Instead of defining ethics in terms of the right act, he defines ethics in terms of the ideally good person. You figure out what a good person is, you think what would a good person do, and then you act accordingly. And Aristotle has this idea that ethics, you can't learn ethics out of a book. Ethics is a skill. He compares it to archery. And he says, like any skill, you need practice. And you can learn a little bit from a book, but then you need to try to apply it. And so you might think about it as being, and I think I might make this comparison in the text, it's like learning to drive a stick shift. So you think about anybody here who doesn't know how to drive a stick shift? Okay, a few. I had huge anxiety. I didn't start driving until I was like, I think I was 20, 21, something like that. So pretty late in life. And then, so I already sort of, you know, was a late bloomer when it came to the automobiles. And then, but then when it came to drive the stick shift, I was like terrified of like making a left turn across traffic and stalling out in the middle and being stuck there when the light changed and getting T-boned by all the, or having the cars honking at me while I'm trying to start the car and get it in gear. So I actually paid a driving instructor because my wife said there was no way in hell she was going to do it, and all my friends were terrified. And so you're sitting there, and you know, you read it on the internet or in a book, and it says, okay, you ease off the clutch as you press down the accelerator. Sounds easy, right? And so you like lurch forward, and then you try it again. And after a while, you kind of find that sweet spot. You're like, oh, okay, I get it. And then so you can read in a book, but until you're actually doing it, you don't really get how it's supposed to go. And I think Aristotle in the same way says you can learn through instruction when you're a child. Hopefully your parents will instruct you. They'll punish you when you beat up your little brother and sister. They'll reward you when you act kindly or obey your parents or clean up your room or do all the things you're supposed to. And then, but later on, it's going to be up to you to learn those virtues, those skills which are going to help you to be a successful person. And so a good example of this would be like courage. So there's a book called The Red Badge of Courage, which probably a lot of you had to read in high school. Is there anybody that hasn't read The Red Badge of Courage?
Have not.
Wow. They don't make you read that in high school? Was there anybody that didn't have it assigned in school? So it was assigned but just not read? So it's this great book by Stephen Crane, who actually died fairly young. And it's only his only real major work. But it's about the Civil War, and it's about learning courage. And there's the first battle engagement, this guy's, he signed up, he's gung-ho to fight for his side, and he's there, and he's got his rifle, and he's getting ready, and then like he's like just scared to death. But he thinks he's going to fight. But then when the battle starts, all of a sudden like it's a blank, and he finds himself running for his life. And just like a coward. And then he like hates himself. He's like, oh, you know, angry at himself. And then later on, he like sort of kind of sneaks back in with the regiment. And somebody says, like, where were you go? What happened to you? Or, you know, what kind of action did you see? And he sort of like fibs about it and hopes that nobody knows that he was a deserter. You know, yeah, he's a yellow belly. But then the next time, he kind of like, it's not as scary, and he's able to like get off a couple shots and sort of, you know, he's able to fight. And then at the end, you know, he's a man and he can run into battle and shoot and not fear death. And so and Aristotle thinks about courage as a sort of, you think about like your green military recruit who's scared of his own shadow, or maybe he's kind of like a berserker, he's gung-ho, and he's going to like when the commander says to sit tight when there's sniper fire coming down by below. He's the guy who wants to run out from behind his hiding place going, ah, you know, and shooting, and he's going to get himself killed. And that's not good either. And Aristotle actually has this notion of virtue as a kind of sweet spot in between where it's not too much of something and not too little of something, but it's sort of, you know, just right in the middle. And that's where the virtue is. And the if you get too much of it, that's the excess, and that's vicious, or it's a vice. If there's too little of it, it's a vice. But if it's someplace in the middle, not always exactly in the middle, but someplace in the middle is the virtue. So, and maybe I'll just... turn this off for a minute. Courage. Courage is something like the right amount of fighting. He's thinking about this literally. You might, and you might put it at the right time too. So depending on the circumstances. So over here, yeah, like the yellow-bellied coward, who's gonna run, you know, at the sight of his own shadow. Reminds me of a one-liner from Gilligan. He said, I'm not a coward, I just faint at the sight of my own blood. So that's the coward. And then you have a then over here you have too much fighting. So what would that be? It's like sort of berserkerhood or something. Berserkerness. Berserker. Aristotle uses the word usually translated brashness or foolhardiness. So here you're not even using your head, you're fighting no matter what. Even when you're hopelessly outnumbered, even when there's no chance you'll even meet your military objective. So like when the 300 Spartans held the mountain pass and held off 10,000 invading Persians, it was a courageous act because even though they're outnumbered and even though they're all going to get killed, it fulfilled the military objective in that it gave the Greeks enough time to muster an army to fight the Persians. And so, you know, sometimes you can die courageously. But if that mountain pass wasn't really important and there was no way the Greek armies were going to get there in time and it was just like foolish, you know, there's no reason to get yourself killed. And when the other side is, you know, shooting arrows one after the other at your position, you got a nice hiding place there. It's not cowardly to crouch and wait for the arrows to stop for a minute or wait for your commander to signal something or, you know, to sort of keep cover and not attack. And so how do you decide what to do? Well, it's someplace in between here and more. Where would you think, like, on a continuum between... not always running away and always fighting, where would the virtue of courage be?
A little more than that.
Yeah, someplace over here, right? You know, we can't like quantify it really, but maybe it's even over here, right? So courage, fighting most of the time, but not being an idiot about it. And so this is the mean between extremes. It's a good little mnemonic device there. The mean between extremes. And it's a mean between the extremes of deficiency or lack of something, or having too much of something, in excess. So it's a mean between the excess, it's a mean between the extremes of excess and deficiency. And Aristotle thinks that every virtue, so courage is the virtue. So Aristotle thinks for every virtue there's going to be some extreme on either side, and then there's going to be some spot, some place in the middle where the virtue is. How do you tell exactly where in the middle? Practice. You got to go out there and fight, make some mistakes, run away at the wrong time, fight at the wrong time, and hopefully not get killed. And then you realize, okay, then you become like a seasoned war veteran, and you know like how to be like how to know that you might get killed in the next engagement, but not like, you know, shaking your boots and to be able to like hold your rifle steady and to be able to fight in a courageous fashion in spite of being afraid. And again, that takes practice. This keyboard kills me. Okay. Let's see. I think we were... So, definitions here. Let's see. So virtue is first of all, I mean primarily virtue, that's the Greek word arete, we translate virtue. It's a disposition of character, sometimes it's called an excellence of character. It's a disposition of character which leads to success. So these will be questions which will be on the exam, or terms which will be on the exam in questions, so you'll have to see, okay, arete, that means virtue. It's a disposition of character which leads to success. So it's some characteristics you would have which leads to you being a successful person. Put it another way, you know, arete is a disposition of character which leads to eudaimonia.
Can you spell arete, please?
Oh. Somebody said
he seems to be reading something off the screen here. Yet I see nothing projected on the projector. What's going on here?
Somebody should clue me in. Yeah, come on.
I'll see it right up there on the screen.
The bulb is going. It's looking kind of weak there. Does it always look that washed out?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe it always looks like that. My eyes are adjusted now. So virtue is a disposition of character which leads to success. So, you know, going back to the beginning, Aristotle's view is it's a teleological theory. It's a theory based on purpose and function. So you figure out what is a good person. And then once you figure out what a good person is, you figure out what human beings were meant to do. Once you do that, you figure out, okay, now we know what the purpose of human beings are and what they're meant to do. What are the things that are going to help them do that? And that's the virtues. So, and remember, your purpose is to be an intellectual, or I suppose to live, you know, a life where you use your mind, if you want to put it more broadly. And to be... a person who uses their rational nature, who acts as a really good example of a rational animal, you have to have certain characteristics which will help you survive, which will help you thrive, which will help you develop your talents, skills, and abilities, which will help you actualize yourself as a rational person. And that's what the virtues are. So, again, you know, Aristotle doesn't think that a virtue is something that's for schmucks, and it's like helping little old ladies across the street, or that it's sacrificing yourself for others. He thinks this is something that's going to help you. And this is, Aristotle kind of thinks about this in the way that Rand does, and you think about like the Dale Carnegie school of, you know, win friends and influence people. How do you get ahead in life? By stabbing your neighbor in the back, by being a jerk, by losing your temper all the time, by gorging yourself on unhealthy food, by getting drunk and screaming at 3 o'clock in the morning and ending up in jail. No, I mean, those are all things that are going to be bad for you, right? You're going to end up in jail. Nobody's going to be your friend. You're going to end up with health problems. And so virtues are things which will help you avoid those things. It's like moderation in eating and drinking. You know, be a beneficent person. Be generous. Be a loyal friend. And if you use use your head when it comes to your finances, and don't let your desires, you know, control you and push you around. And so if you have all those virtues of self-discipline and loyalty and honesty and integrity, then people are going to want to hire you for a job. People are going to want to be your friend. When you're down and out, your friends are going to come to your aid. It's going to be good for you to be a virtuous person. So these are things which help you to be successful. And then Aristotle also thinks that, as a matter of fact, you put a bunch of these people together and they're going to form a good society. So there's no distinction between like the good of society and good of the individual. What's good for the individual is what's good for society. Okay, so what is a disposition? A disposition is just a tendency to act in a certain way. So you might say salt has a disposition to dissolve in water. If you say a person has like if you said that, I'm trying to think of somebody who has a volatile disposition. Christian Bale has a volatile disposition, right? There's this famous episode where it's on YouTube, where like gaffer, one of the crew guys, like walks into the shot where he's supposed to be giving like this like really important performance, and he's venting his spleen, and all of a sudden he sees this guy behind, and he just starts letting out this stream of expletives. And of course now everybody's seen it, and he's like embarrassed and had to apologize. But there's a person with a volatile disposition, right? He tends to explode in rage or feelings, and you probably know people like that. So now it doesn't mean that every time you meet Christian Bale at some sort of a red carpet event, and they say, "Oh, I'm a fan of your work," and he says, "Really? You're really a fan?" He doesn't get really. No, he doesn't get angry then. So, and maybe something bad happens, like he gets his limousine gets a flat tire. It doesn't mean that he explodes, but it means that he has a tendency to get really, really angry at small provocations. It doesn't mean he always does that, but it's just a tendency he has. And so a virtue is a tendency or a habit of acting in a certain way under certain conditions. So a virtue, again, is a mean between the extremes of excess and deficiency. Too much of something, too little of something. Which is just what I had up there on the board. So you should remember, in English grammar, there's a word between what... The repetition of vowels. I don't remember what it is now. It's a fancy word but it's a mean between the extremes. So if you can remember the E sound, it's a mean between the extremes. Excess and deficiency, too much and too little. You think about like the tale of the three bears, right? Where Goldilocks and the three bears, where Goldilocks comes into the bear's den, and there's the three bowls of porridge, and one's too hot, the other one's too cold, and the third one's just right. That's the virtue, the one that's just right. Not too much, not too little. Virtue is learned through a good upbringing. So again, childhood, child rearing, very important. And this is a case where you can give Aristotle a lot of credit. I don't think anybody really picked this up until probably Piaget, in like the 19th century, said, let's look at child rearing. That seems to be really important to moral development and development of the personality. And here's Aristotle writing in ancient Greece and realizing that it's really important how you bring up children, and that your basic habits as an adult are going to be formed in childhood, and they're going to be very difficult to break if you get bad habits, and the good habits are going to stick. And so he doesn't think that you're kind of ruined if you have a bad upbringing and that you're doomed to be a moral reprobate, but it's just that it's easier to stay on the straight and narrow if you're raised in the right way. And if you're raised in a poor way, you're going to have to try extra hard to learn those virtues. Some people might know from experience, right, about how, but their parents, they had to raise themselves, or some people, you get these two extremes, like sometimes parents kind of coddle children, like my parents sort of coddled me, and so I was really insecure as a child, and I didn't get to do a lot of things, and I'd be told I want to do all this stuff, and I'd be told no, and I came to become really dependent on my parents. And it, you know, so when they put me, dropped me off at kindergarten, I cried because I wanted my mommy, right? All the other kids were fine. And then after a while, I adjusted. But, you know, I would always want to do stuff like join the Boy Scouts or, you know, the different things that looked really interesting to me. And my parents were like, no, that's too dangerous, or no, you know, I couldn't go out. Everybody else could ride the bus off to the mall, and I'd have to have my mom take me and stuff. And it made me kind of dependent. And so even as an adult, like, I have to push myself to do something new and unusual, to go someplace I've never been before, to do something new and sort of risky. I'm very risk averse. Why am I risk averse? That's because my parents told me, oh, the most important thing is avoid risk at all costs. Get a nice safe job. They wanted to be an optometrist or a pharmacist or something like that. And you didn't work in it. They all worked as like state bureaucrats, like in a county and stuff. So, you know, safe government job, right? And, you know, where am I? I'm a safe government job, right? So it's, you know, we haven't. I try to take risks in my own little ways on the side, but I mean, that's so. It shows you that the way you're raised as a child, you know, it forms your personality and your habits later in life. So if you're raised like by, think about like if you're like Oliver Twist, and maybe not Oliver Twist, but maybe like one of the boys that came to like Fagin, the sort of master of thieves who has all these orphan children that steal for him. And he teaches them, like, since they're so high, like, how to like, pick somebody's pocket, right? And they're thinking picking pockets is great. So once they, you know, grow up, it's always going to be that temptation to scam somebody, to steal something. Whereas, like, a normal person, if they see someone, like, puts their wallet on the counter and turns around, they're not thinking, oh, I'd really like to swipe that wallet. I just go like this, and I just walk off, and it would be mine. Whereas a normal person wouldn't think that. Whereas if you're raised from the time you're this high to be a thief, you're like, oh, I'm going to grab that, you know. And then this little voice says, no, 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 that's wrong, remember? But it's always a sort of gut reaction. So you learn through a good upbringing. And then as an adult, you sort of fine-tune things. And again, you know, the example I talked about earlier, you learn to be courageous through trying to be courageous. Through attempting and sometimes failing to act courageously. And this is, I don't know, there's probably lots of anecdotes you could add about, like, learning how to do something right after failing. Of an acquaintance who likes to use this phrase, failing forward. I don't know if that's original with him, but that's his philosophy, is that you learn by pushing yourself to the limits of your ability and until you like screw up, right? So you're kind of always pushing against that sort of upper level ability, because if you stay within what you're comfortable with, you never really grow your talents and abilities. But it's always kind of pushing the envelope, being on the bleeding edge of he's in technology. So, and he does like graphic arts and special effects for the movies and things, and he's always trying to learn how to do things better and better and better, until like he can't do something very good, and then he gets frustrated and he's like, why isn't it perfect? And then he keeps on working on it until he kind of fine tunes it, until he gets it what he wants. But then if he kept on doing that, that would sort of be the new normal, so he's pushing against the next thing. And I think Aristotle would very much like that idea of sort of always aiming at, you know, the bullseye, to take his archer analogy, and trying to correct course and make little adjustments to figure out what you're doing wrong. And I mentioned this before too, just hit it one more time, that there's no distinction between the good life in the natural and moral senses. Now, what's the good life in the natural sense? A good life is like being healthy, being wealthy, being wise, having lots of friends, being happy, right? That's, when you ask people what they want out of life, that's usually the things they mention. They want to have, you know, health and having good relationships, right? All those things are part of having a good life, just in the ordinary sense of, what's a good life? Well, I don't know, live a long time and have a bunch of friends and have enough money and be happy, maybe a little excitement, right? And so that, and what Aristotle would say is that that isn't different from your duty, your moral duty, because those the same things which will make you give you a good life in the ordinary natural sense is going to give you a moral life, because it's those same qualities of honesty and integrity and courage and moderation or temperance that are going to give you a long life and a healthy life and a happy life. So it's, again, contrast with Kant. Kant says, here is my happy, healthy, feel good, every day is Christmas type life, but then there's my duty, and I have to choose between the two, and I guess I'll do my duty, because that's, and I really, really want to do this other, these other things over here, because they're a lot more attractive, but no, I have to sacrifice myself, push all this stuff aside, follow, do my duty, which is going to be really, really painful and make me a gloomy guest, but it's what I got to do, because morality says I got to follow this moral rule, even though it's going to ruin me and everybody around me. But if I get lucky, maybe my duty will turn out well for me. But Kant makes this radical distinction between duty and what's going to give you a good life. And he says often, you know, self-interest is going to be on one side, and then morality is going to be on the other side. Aristotle says, no, self-interest and duty, they're the same thing. And what it's actually in your interest to be a virtuous person, and you'll have a good life in both senses if you develop these virtues within yourself.
The other day you explained how his Germanic upbringing and the context of where he grew up and all that, that really mm-hmm. helped clarify for me the distinction between those two views that he saw. What would be the context here of Aristotle and his view of those coming together and melding? And
that's a good question. I think that the ancient Greeks were very individualistic. They were one of the first societies where, like, individuals had real rights. Now, slaves didn't have rights, and women didn't have many rights. But you know, individual Greek citizens, you had a democracy, you had certain rights guaranteed you by the state. And so in that kind of individualist culture, there is, I mean, the only notion of morality is really the kind of religious morality. It's like, here's what the gods want you to do. But even then, like, this idea of a kind of a universal morality which applied to everyone is just sort of starting to be developed. And the idea of a sense of morality which is totally divorced from self-interest, I think it isn't really part of the way they thought about life. So this idea of an impersonal duty that you would follow no matter what really doesn't come until kind of later on, maybe with the Stoics or something like that. And then later on with Christianity. And it's interesting here too that Christianity kind of adopts Aristotle as a patron saint and uses his works, and like Thomas Aquinas, you know, basically uses Aristotle as crib notes for doing philosophy. And a lot of Aquinas is, you know, here's this philosophical problem, and here's what Aristotle says about it, and now I'm going to, like, clarify what Aristotle said, and I'm going to bring some quotes, some stuff from the Bible, and kind of show how it all meshes together. Even though Aristotle is pagan, Aquinas refers to him as the philosopher. So let's say, the philosopher says, you know, blah, 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 and quote him like he quotes the Bible, and he puts, you know, Aristotle and the Bible sort of as two authorities, and he thinks that they go together, like, basically faith and reason. And it's a kind of a synthesis between the two. So, yeah, I think that, again, at the time, people were really individualistic in that sense. All right. And the only kind of morality was sort of authoritarian, the gods said so, sort of stuff like we saw in the Euthyphro. So virtue means doing something the right amount at the right time, or the right time, the right amount. Either way is fine. Some examples of virtue, we just talked about courage. Temperance. So temperance is the right amount of eating and drinking. And we might apply it to other things too, but the eating and drinking thing.
Easy. Let's see, where's the
had a student in the elevator, and she's like, "Oh, it looks like you lost weight." I'm like, "Oh, really? No, thank you." So I said, "Temperance at work there. So you're not eating that cheesecake and driving by and like, oh, they have that Hershey's pie thing at Burger King. It's so delicious." It's like it was a little box. He's like, "Oh, I just really love. No, I'm going home and like eat a salad." Right? So I eat temperance. So it's the right amount of eating and drinking. And we might say also the right side too. So. The right amount. So, kind of just get like this. It's somebody trying to find a point. It's like, why would you do that? Are they just pressing really hard?
Passionate.
Okay, so, yeah, temperance is a virtue, sometimes called moderation. And then, what would be the deficiency? And this is right amount of eating and drinking. What's that?
On the other side?
Oh, then there's the excess. The excess is the too much is over here. So what do you call somebody that like me, I guess, who's a tinkler or a non-alcoholic? So like here, like a kind of a, you might say like a person like an ascetic. There's some people that they don't really enjoy their food, and they're like kind of like sickly and weak. They don't eat enough. They have no appetite, and they don't really pay attention to eating. It doesn't really, or they have some sort of kind of crazy body image, and they think that it looks sexy for the ribs to stick out, and they're kind of like a twin person. And so I suppose you might say even anorexic, even though it's like a neurological disease, anorexic. Kind of sickly, I don't know what else. Actually, it turns out that the one thing you can do, it's like to live the longest, is like not eat and eat like nutritious food, but just eat less of it. Like eat about like 1,400 calories a day or something like that, and you'll live a long time. Or maybe it'll just seem longer. But well, actually, there is scientific evidence that shows that's the only thing they figured out that will extend maximum lifespan. So you can like live longer, like not by not getting cancer or heart disease and so on, by changing what you eat. But the only thing that's been guaranteed to like make you actually live more years, and you know, be healthy years too, is not eating very much. So I actually have an acquaintance who looks kind of sickly. He looks kind of skeletal and sucking in, but he's actually really healthy. His cholesterol's like, you know, under 100. He's really healthy. But, you know, there's some people, like, I have a friend who's, like, addicted to video games, and he's, like, playing for, like, hours at a time, and he feels, like, this really annoying pang in his stomach that's like, oh, I haven't eaten, I'll have to quit my video game. And then what does he do? He goes and, like, boils, like, one hot dog in like, a pan and eats it and brings it back and puts it on a plate and eats it and goes back to his video game. And so that's, you know, that's bad for him, right? So you're going to have some health problems if you're, like, underweight. And then, but this is usually, like, you know, what poor people, most people suffer, right? So this is, like, a good old word, gluttony, drunkenness. You know what being a drunken alcoholic is? Us drunks don't have to go to all those dang meetings. but I mean, Aristotle, if you were to say that drunkenness is a disease, he would say, like, you know, give me a break. It's not like, you know, tuberculosis or something like that. Drunkenness is a habit. that happens when you like get in the habit of drinking and drinking and drinking. Now, there is some like physical addiction, so there's physical addiction, but it's primarily psychological, because you can get over the physical addiction if you got the shakes or something like that. You have to kind of wean yourself off it. But it's primarily like you really want that drink, and it's not, and then you feel bad if you don't get it. But it's a psychological habituation. It's a behavior. And so these things are really bad. And then, you know, here it'd be sort of right in the middle, right? You want to be aerosol instead of enjoy your food, enjoy your drink. You think if somebody doesn't know how to enjoy their wine, they're kind of like a killjoy, they're a gloomy guest. Nobody wants to be around them. Nobody likes a teetotaler. And then over here, you might have some health problems. You're going to end up, saying things you regret. You're going to like be big as a house. You're going to have a hard time getting along. You're going to get the gout, right? The diabetes, right? So it's not going to be good. Let's see, some of the other virtues. Honesty. So here it's... let's put this here. Okay, now that's proof that why honesty is such a lonely word. Honesty is the right amount of truth-telling. So it's the right amount of truth-telling. So what would be like the excess? Or what is the deficiency you want?
Deficiency would be a liar or...
Yeah, so that's a pretty easy one, right? Liar, like a pathological liar. Person lies all the time. Can you be too truthful?
Tattletale?
Yeah, I suppose like a, Tattletale or rat meat. But even how about something else? That these might be kind of, it might be loaded terms. Like you say, you should, if somebody's doing something they're not supposed to, you should rat on them. Should be a designated smoking area, damn it. Whatever. So what if, your wife says, does this dress make me look fat? So are you going to say yes? Or, honey, every dress makes you look fat, because you're fat, No, you want to kind of massage the truth a little bit, say, oh honey, you always look beautiful to me, or something like that, right? So, there's some case where you can be like, brutally honest or overly frank, right? So there's cases maybe where you should hold your tongue and not say the truth, or maybe you just shouldn't speak, and there might be some cases, like Aristotle would think, where you don't want to volunteer information, or even where you might tell a little white lie, and that's probably fine. You may think of a case where maybe telling a little white lie seems like it'd be a good idea, besides my old holdback about, does this dress make me look fat? What if you have a friend who's like an artist, and you look at his or her art, and you're like, doesn't really do anything for me. I don't know much about art, but it doesn't seem that good to me, And the person's like, hey, what do you think? And you say, oh, that's nice. I like the little colors in the flower there or whatever. You try to find something nice to say about it. Now, you maybe don't want to rave about it, but you don't want to say, it's kind of mediocre. You really think you're going to make it as an artist? It seems kind of doubtful to me. You're going to, crush that person's spirit. And maybe, over time, maybe they'll develop into a better artist, but... You want to kind of say something kind of bland and nice. So it's, again, it's, where's it going to be? It's going to be more towards telling the truth. It's going to be way over here. And so on with all the other virtues. Pride. Pride is an interesting one. So pride for Aristotle is a virtue. And Christianity comes around the corner, pride goeth before a fall. It's a vice. So pride is what Aristotle says is the right. It's taking the right account of your, having the proper esteem for your accomplishments. So having proper self-regard or something. So having the proper regard for yourself, self-regard, and let's say regard for particularly for your accomplishments. So what would be like the accident? What would be the deficiency here? Oops. What's that?
Modesty
or humility.
What about self-debasement?
Yeah, self-debasement. This is sort of, aw shucks man, twert nothing. Any cowpoke would have killed them 100 Indians.
With the jawbone of donkey or whatever, you do something really astounding, you're like, you'd run into a burning building and save 5 babies, and you say, anybody would have done it. Or so the idea is that you don't want to be, so what's the excess?
The braggart.
Yeah, the braggart, the booster. Here you're bragging about things you didn't do. Or maybe you're tooting your horn a little too much. Like, I had a student, which shall remain nameless, who had a position in an organization and would introduce himself as the head of this organization to everyone he met, even when these people had like no connection to his organization at all. He's like, I'm so-and-so, president of such and such a group. And just because he liked doing it. He actually, one time, he was ordering a pizza for the club's event. And he said, this is so-and-so, president of such and such club. I'd like to order some pizzas. it's totally irrelevant. He wants people to know that he's the president of something. And he found it, and then he... the club has like a loose affiliation with a national organization. It's not like it doesn't have chapters, but it sort of got the name on the website of this now. And he's like, I'm a representative of an international organization. So that's like, and usually that's showing you have like some self-esteem problems. So anyway, you have So the bragger, the boaster, and then the person who's humble. And Aristotle says this is really a bias here. So you ever hear like this? What does an athlete say when they've like accomplished some really great play and they stick the microphone in his face? What does he usually say? Or what are some of the things you say which might be illustrative of what Aristotle would call vice?
Couldn't have done it without that guy. The other guy did really good.
And yeah.
Speak on their own.
Right, it was a team effort, So I'm just a member of the team. What else? What do people say? What do people say when they get like awards and things, like the Academy Awards or Country Music Awards or whatever, Grammys?
They think everybody else.
Yeah, they think everybody else that helped them out, right? They don't say. I'm trying to remember that Kathy Lee Gifford got like an Emmy for a comedy routine. I think her quote was, everybody comes up there and they get this award and they want to thank Jesus for it. Well, let me tell you, Jesus had nothing to do with this reward. And then she said, suck it, Jesus. This is my God now. And she's making fun of people that will say, it wasn't me that like, did this, got an Academy Award. It was the Lord Jesus Christ working through me. And I'm just, humble servant and so on. And Aristotle would say, if you're going to give God the God's accomplishments for what you did, it's your like moment of fame, and you're like, want to say, well, this is God's doing, it's not mine. When you, work your hiney off to get that award, there's something wrong with you. It would be Aristotle's view. And And you know, there's a debate here about how much health regard you should have at all. You know, Kathy Lee Gifford is obviously one extreme. But then there are people that will say, well, you know, that they'll want to thank God and Jesus for giving them the power and the strength and the talents to do these things. Where Aristotle would say, well, yeah, maybe you got those things. And Aristotle kind of believes in a God, but it's kind of abstract, and he's kind of abstract and remote. But he would say, no, you take pride in your accomplishments. Like, there's a place in the Bible, and I think the big contrast between Aristotle and Christianity comes out where the Bible, in the book of James, it says, you people, you say things like, oh, tomorrow we shall go to such and such a place and do business. What you ought to say is, if the Lord wills it, then we'll go to such and such a place and do business. And the idea is that you have, keep in your mind that it's only through God's permission and will that you're able to do anything. And like Aristotle would say that that's kind of an extreme of more towards the vice, and you ought to say, well, no, if you did, you know, pick whatever accomplishment you may have accomplished, think of something, well, it might be something you accomplish. You take pride in it. You graduate, right? Everybody here wants to get some kind of degree or certificate. You graduate, you would say, you know, this is my day, I deserve credit for graduating, and glory to me, or, you know, yay, I got my degree, and you proudly display the little certificate on your wall, and you feel good about yourself. And that's the way you should feel. You shouldn't feel guilty, and you shouldn't feel that it's wrong for you to bask in the glory of the moment. You should feel good about it. Generosity is also something that he says is part of being virtuous. Now, here's a case where it doesn't necessarily go along with obviously with self-interest. That in Aristotle's view, you know, being generous, it's sort of like being a human being. You see somebody in need, you want, in generosity, what would be like the excess for generosity, which is a virtue?
Giving away to the point where you have nothing.
Right. Yeah, so you're like, you know, like a bleeding heart or a martyr or something like that. Care too much. Like the stereotypical Jewish mother that sacrifices everything for her son, who's always a huge disappointment. Can't you be a doctor and a lawyer like your brother? You know, it's like that. I scraped and saved for you to go to college and become a philosopher.
Must be a rabbi.
Yeah. Not even a rabbi, a philosopher. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you want to, when you're dealing with generosity, you don't want to like sacrifice your interest too much. You just want to give enough where you kind of feel good about it, you help people out. And then, like, the deficiency would be like a
miser.
Miser, yeah.
Dingy.
So you're going to be, again, someplace in between here. Don't want to give away the farm. So Christianity came along and kind of modified virtue ethics. And so in Christianity, you get faith and love being the focus. And again, I said Aristotle sort of adopted it as a kind of a Christian philosopher, even though he's a pagan.
Can you pull the screen down?
Oh, thank you. So Aristotle added, Christianity added faith instead of emphasis on reason, and this idea of love of God and your fellow man as being virtues. So you have this faith, hope, and charity being sort of the three virtues of Christianity. But these other things sort of stick around. Pride gets replaced with humility and this idea of being a servant. And Aristotle would just think this would be awful. And Nietzsche kind of, we'll look at Nietzsche, he kind of rails against Christianity and says, this is the problem that, you know, Christianity took a perfectly good philosopher, Aristotle, and kind of, you know, turned him on his head and said, oh, you know, pride is a vice and humility is a virtue, when it's the other way around. And I suppose when it comes to humility, the question is, you know, how much is too much? How much is too much self-regard, and how much is not enough? And that's, I suppose, a matter of debate. Another one here? Oh, yeah. And so also poverty. Aristotle would disagree that poverty is a virtue. You know, Jesus said, blessed are the poor. Another version, blessed are the poor in spirit. But Jesus had a lot of bad things to say about rich people. And a lot of good things he would say about poor people. And Aristotle would say, well, you want to be rich. And, you know, having a lot of wealth is a virtue. Because it allows you to, again, to be an intellectual. Because intellectuals, they need, like, you know, ideally a six-figure professor salary, you know, to sort of, and somebody to polish the windows in the ivory tower. That's like the way to philosophize in style. Otherwise, you might have to, you know, spend a lot of time grading papers and lecturing, or you could be writing. And you can go to the University of Oregon, it's all like research and conferences and things. And you're lucky if they give you the time of day if you're an undergrad. Well, some are good, but that's what I hear. That's a scuttlebutt I hear from students when they move on to the U, that it's all the grad assistant, and it's tough getting FaceTime with the professor. So what are some pros and cons of Aristotle's theory? Well, one great thing about ethics under Aristotle is that it's empirically justified. And that means that empirical justification means it's justified through experience or through the senses. So to figure out what's right or wrong is really it's what works and what will make you successful. And it's this kind of trial and error process. You can check to see how well you're doing. And given that you have some goal, which is one of like the basic human goals, like to be, you know, this all comes back to the life of the mind and being a fully actualized person. And you're like, well, you know, shooting heroin isn't doing, it's, you know, it's not actualizing me as a human being. So maybe I should quit shooting heroin. Or, yeah, it's, you know, ethics is seen as a skill, and you get trial and error, probably trial and error, you can see how you're doing. And it's also empirically justified in that it's based on human nature. So instead of these kind of abstract rules that you have to kind of deduce from logic, as Kant says, and I suppose, you know, the utilitarianism too tries to abstract out rules of morality, and you know, Mill tries to prove that happiness is the only thing of intrinsic worth, and doesn't do a very good job of it. So both, you know, utilitarianism and deontology have these sort of abstract principles, whereas in Aristotle it's all based on human nature, which is empirical, right? What are human beings like? Well, let's look at them. What are they doing? How are they different from the plants and animals? What is it that distinguishes them from all the other animals? Oh, they're using their head. They're using their reason. What are those things which allow you to, you know, live the life of the mind? Well, here are all the practical things that you need to have to actualize your potential as a rational animal. And that's the virtues. So it all kind of fits together in a nice little package. And Aristotle says you look at human beings and figure out what human nature is, and then you get a list of skills that you need to be a good human being. And there's none of this lofty abstract principles. It's all very concrete and based on senses and on deducing from human nature what the best way to live is. I've mentioned this before, there's no egoism, altruism, dichotomy. What's good for you is what's good for others. What's good for you is what's good for others. And the other thing is that Aristotle seems to really understand the role of judgment. And what I mean by unquantifiable judgment, well, unquantifiable just means you can't measure it. And this goes back to what I was talking about you can't learn ethics from a book. Ethics can kind of get you a head start. You can read Aristotle's, you know. Aristotle obviously thinks it has some value because he's writing about ethics, but he thinks to have virtue, you can't just read a book and close the book and say, okay, now I'm ready to be virtuous. You have to go out there and try to be courageous and honest and generous and have integrity. And sometimes you're going to make a mistake and you have to correct mistakes as you go along and try to figure out, you know, how to deal with stressful situations, how not to lose your temper when everyone around you is, in a screaming match. What to do when you're accosted by a gang of hooligans. and you have to fight for your life, right? What to do when you have some moral dilemma, when it's a question about should you tell the truth to your friend that his wife is cheating on him or something, right? And Aristotle thinks that unless you've sort of encountered some of those kinds of situations, it doesn't have to be the particular kind of situation, but unless you encounter situations where you have to exercise your virtue, you're gonna screw up. And the more you practice, the better you get. And the more virtuous you become. If you work at it. If you don't work at it, then you're just gonna be, I suppose if you follow the exercise, an exercise metaphor, you're gonna be flabby and out of shape. And then when you have to, like, you know, sprint 100 yards, you're going to fall over or die of a heart attack or something. So it's a matter of ethics is a skill, and you have to use your judgment to figure out exactly where that meaning is to figure out what you should do and whether doing something would be foolhardiness, whether it would be brashness, or whether it would be courageous, or whether it would be cowardice. So Aristotle had a chance to exercise his virtue when the Macedonian regime worked under. He worked for Philip of Macedon, and his son was Alexander the Great. Aristotle tutored Alexander the Great, and then there was like a regime change, and Aristotle may or may not have exercised the virtue. I guess he like basically left town. He fled for his life. And his famous quip was that he was actually in the city of Athens, and he said he left lest Athens sin twice against philosophy. So what do you think that would mean? Athens sinning twice against philosophy. When was the first time they sinned against philosophy?
It wasn't to drink the
Socrates, right?
Socrates and what he drank.
Hemlock, yeah.
Is that the first sin?
Yeah, it was the first sin, right? So, I mean, basically, Socrates, who was Plato's teacher, Plato was Aristotle's teacher. So you have Socrates, Plato, then Aristotle. And so Socrates is the father of philosophy. And so they killed off Socrates, and like, they killed off Socrates, by God, they're going to kill off Aristotle. So he's like, I'm leaving. I'm not going to die a martyr's death. So I'll leave it up to you whether that was an act of... Well, what do you think? Was that an act of courage, like fleeing the city, or was it an act of cowardice?
I would just be smart.
Well, there you go. So
it might be just reasoned his way that this is the best thing to do.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to call that courageous running away, but I mean that's the right amount of fighting. So it would have been courageous to stay. It would have been foolhardy. I think Aristotle would say, what would it accomplish? Is it going to bring philosophy forward? Is it going to make people any more rational? Is it going to make society any better? No, it's just going to mean that the world is going to be deprived of the philosophy of Aristotle. And he did work after that. A lot of his most enduring work came after he fled Athens. So it's probably a good thing that he didn't stay. Oh, some problems. So this whole thing about everything having a purpose. So what's the purpose of a hammer? To pound nails, okay. What's the purpose of the eye? To see. all right, the heart pumps blood. Well, you can kind of look at it and see that it, that's what it does. It does it better than a liver, right? So lungs don't pump blood very well. If you try to get the lungs to pump blood, it wouldn't work so well. You can kind of see that. But then you say, like, what's the purpose of a frog? Eat flies? I mean, you say it's the purpose of a frog to eat flies. That's what it does, but to say it's its purpose, what's the purpose of a rock? To sit there, to be hard? I mean, it. So it seems like this idea that every natural thing has a purpose. It seems that, like, if you believe in a God who designed the world in a certain way, then it, you know, it kind of makes sense, right? God designed the frog to be part of the ecosystem, if you want. But if you believe in evolution, then the frog only has a purpose in kind of like a faux sense of like emergent order. He has a place in the ecological system, but it's not like he has a purpose. And then you have like human beings, and do human beings really have this particular purpose? Just because you're designed to have certain things that you're best at, does that mean that's what you should actually do? Like, it might be like there's people that have, there might be a person that has like a really powerful skill, but they just don't like doing it. Like, suppose you have really excellent mathematical skills. And I don't know if mine are off the chart, but I tested into calculus, and I took it when I was like a junior in high school. And it was just, there's so much homework, and it's so boring, it's so abstract, I couldn't apply to anything. I'm like, this is just not the best use of my time. So I'm like, I dropped the class. I'm like, I could do it, but I wasn't interested in it. And so maybe like certain things, and I suppose Aristotle might say that's like the most rational, he'd probably say philosophy is the most rational of the fields of knowledge. But if you think of mathematics as being sort of super, super rational, or using all your logical faculties, and, you know, not the senses hardly at all, it's the most abstract of the fields of knowledge. If I'm really good at math, should I be doing math? Or should everybody be doing math or philosophy or what have you? So it might be that I like enjoy other things. And maybe that I should do what I enjoy doing, not like what I was, maybe there's not anything I was meant to do. So that's, this whole idea of purposes might be, you know, problematic. And this idea of human beings have a certain nature, and that defines what they should do. Is there a virtue for every moral value? Can you think of something like an example of something that wouldn't fit on Aristotle's kind of mean between extremes setup here? That would be like a part of ordinary moral judgment. Like, what are some basic moral rules? See if this works for, like, things that you just, like, every day, or things that most people would agree on.
Don't murder,
right? So what's, like, the mean between, what are the two extremes?
The mass murder.
Being a mass murder, then what's, like, the deficiency?
Don't kill any living thing.
Yeah, like a extreme pacifist or something like that. It's kind of weird to describe, like, the fact that you shouldn't kill other people as a matter of, like, not enough killing, too much killing. Just the right amount of killing is way over the side towards not killing people. And you think, well, what does the amount to? Like, what does it mean that there's, like, very little killing is where the meaning is? It's, and you come up with things like, well, it's okay in self-defense, but not if you're really angry. And you're doing things other than, like, measuring the amount of something. Too much or too little of it. You're like weighing other considerations. How about like stealing? The right amount of, you know, regard for private property rights or something. I mean, you have to bring in other notions like of property rights or something. The right amount of taking what's not yours. What's that?
Why are we stealing?
Yeah, you have to ask the question like why would, you know, it seems like when you're talking about stealing is wrong generally, but then like you make exceptions if there's like some overriding consideration. But to say there's some virtue called, like, I don't know what you would call it, the virtue of being not a thief or something, and it's like, the virtue of being not a thief is when you don't steal unless it's absolutely necessary or something. And so it seems like it's kind of forced and artificial when you try to put some of these basic moral rules in there. So it might be good for some things, but it might not be a complete moral theory. You know, the kind of Marxist critique of Aristotle. He's universalizing the bourgeois intellectual values of his culture. And he basically says, what's the ideal life? Well, it's, you know, of course, it's being a philosopher. And, you know, the slave boy pours the wine and you, like, you know, start philosophizing with your friends and he writes some stuff and tutor a prince and go off to the Olympic Games. And it's, you know, it seems that some of what Aristotle thinks is virtue and the good life is really the life that he has, and it's the life of the sort of elite upper, you know, upper echelon of Greek society. And so, like, for your, you know, average guy, you might think, well, what about the slave? What about a woman, right? And Aristotle says, they, you know, they have their place. Like, to be a good slave, you have to, like, you know, pour the right amount of wine at the right time or something.
So you're saying that he's an elitist?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the criticism, that he's an elitist, and that he's not really explaining universal human values, but he's trying to universalize the values of the Greek aristocracy. And you might say that, you know, the criticism, like, so to have a good life, I have to always have my nose in a book. I should be, like, reading Kant, you know. That seems like a horrible life. I want to go out, like, the thing I love is, like, I like going down to the Cosgrove Speedway and smelling the, you know, the diesel fumes and hearing the roar of the engine. There was a girl in one of my classes who was, like, a mechanic and part of a team at the Cosgrove Speedway. And she loved that stuff. She loved her heavy metal music, and she, like, played in a band. And she, you know, she did okay in the class, but it was like, I can just see, you know, does she really, is the good life for her going to art museums and kind of contemplating the eternal verities and philosophizing? No, I think that would probably be kind of a lousy life for her. It does seem kind of elitist, and it might just be that there's individuals have different things that make them happy and fulfill them. I guess that's it. Comments, questions, objections, extra criticisms. Been kind of heavy on the lecture lately. I just want to make sure I don't fall behind. I was afraid I was going to get sick today and not be able to show up. So I got sick on Friday, so I'm kind of over it by Monday. So and it's getting near the end of the term, so there's not as much catch up time. So right on schedule, on Monday we'll begin with philosopher Nietzsche in the next chapter. He gets his own chapter because Nietzsche is his own man. And so we'll be talking about him. So don't forget to post to the forum by Sunday night. And remember that deadline for making your grading option decisions is Friday, 5 p.m. I think that's it. See you guys on Monday.